This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
And by the way, for Wendy, yeah, were you going to say something, or are you just stretching? She said, when are you going to get to the grace part? Well, the final biblical key is the biblical key of grace. That is the final result and the basis of everything else that we're talking about. Grace is not a blue-eyed blonde. God deals with you not only from His mercy, but from His grace. Every time you eat a meal, listen to your child laugh. Laugh at a joke, collect your paycheck, get out of bed, speak a word. That's God's grace. And I'm going to say a whole lot more about that as we go along. But people are always coming to me in difficult times, and they're saying, do you think God is judging me? You know, one of the reasons that I hope you don't sin really bad, that God makes you better than you are, is because when you sin bad, thereafter, I'm talking about bad sin, thereafter, every bad thing that happens to you will lie to you about the nature of God. I think maybe I told you about a friend of mine. He was a missionary who did some really bad things, went through a divorce. His daughter didn't want him to come to the marriage. It was just incredibly sad, and he wouldn't talk to me, and finally he did. He called me about 3 months ago, and he died 2 months ago. He was driving a semi-truck across America and heard one of my broadcasts in Arizona and called up and just wept on the phone. And he said, I don't have anything anymore. He said, but I like driving a truck. He said, me and Jesus are getting to know each other again. And then he told me about his daughter who had forgiven him and his wife who had forgiven him and what God was doing in his life. But the problem with what he did was not the sin that he committed. The problem with what he did was that every time something bad happened, it lied to him about the nature of God. And so I would say to you, be as faithful as you can, be as obedient as you can, not because God will reject you if you aren't, but because there's this funny thing that happens in human beings, and that is that if we get cancer, it's because we're sinners. Or if our business fails, it's because of that bad thing that we did. And it all has to do, which is the lie that goes against grace, that there are these gigantic scales in the heavens, and that the demons put the bad stuff on one side and the angels put the good stuff on the other side. And the whole purpose of life is to keep them in balance. So if you do something really bad today, tomorrow you'll do something really good so the scales stay in balance. And we all play that game. You know, if I yell at my wife or she yells at me, she feels guilty about it, she'll bake me a cake or I'll bring her flowers. What I'm trying to do is keep the scales in balance so that they don't get out of whack. And what God starts doing, and the principle is God will either allow you to sin greatly or allow you to see the greatness of your sin so that the scales will get out of balance and you will see that the only hope you have is in Him. And it is a sure and steady and certain hope. Great mercy and grace. Let me read you the words of Michael Kelly Blanchard. I love Michael a lot because he does in music, as does Buddy Green, what I do in my teaching. And when we do the Grace for the Moment concerts, I say it and he sings it. And it's powerful because there's something, my wife always says that music is the universal language. Well, try to explain the Graf-Wellhausen documentary hypothesis with music and see how much I pick up on it. It can be the universal language, emotional language, but there has to be a cognitive thing. But the powerful stuff of music as it comes together, Michael does that too. And he said to her, there's nothing so bad you can't confide in me, love. No heartache or lasting regret. Nothing so sad that you've tried to be free of that I won't forgive and forget. Because I love you, I do. Oh, I love you, it's true. I love you, I do, you bet. Somebody sent me a letter and said, I said this was the last one, but it's not. There's one more. I just turned a page and forgot. I get letters like this all the time that says, have you not read Bonhoeffer, you're teaching cheap grace? If it weren't cheap, I couldn't afford it. In fact, if it cost anything, I couldn't afford it. And I think there's a bum rap, and we're coward into not speaking the truth because people say, that's cheap grace. You've got to be committed and obedient and holy. And I agree with those things. You do. But if it weren't cheap, we just couldn't afford it. I love the imagery of the woman who comes to the Episcopal altar to receive communion. And as she does, she starts thinking about her sins, and she backs away from the altar. And the priest takes the communion cup and sticks it in her nose and says, take it, woman. It's for sinners. It's for you. The sixth biblical key, sovereignty, immutability, the nature of God, law, grace, is the presence of God. Psalm 16:11, you will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Some 17, 18 years ago, I came to the realization that I didn't know God. Now, I was saved. That's a judicial act on the part of God that makes sure that I'll get home even though my clothes smell like smoke. That was settled. I understood the substitutionary atonement. I even understood the imputation of Christ's righteousness. I was a Bible teacher, had taught by that time through most of the Bible. I'd seen and led many people to Christ. I had discipled a lot of people. I'd shepherded a lot of people. And I'd written a number of books. And I was the expert. And I met an old lady in my church who couldn't spell and slaughtered the English language and who knew God. And I remember praying, God, I don't know you. And my sin is more real to me than you are. And whatever it takes, I want to know you. I really want to know you. Do you know why pagans don't pray? And we're going to talk a lot about prayer, and I'm never going to get through it tonight. So we'll talk about it some more next week. Because I don't believe you do this stuff without a significant walk with God. And by significant walk with God, it isn't what all the images that came to your mind when I said that are not true. That's not what I'm talking about. Those images come from religion. People are trying to stay out of hell, not from people who've been there. So when I talk about a significant walk with God, it's a lot different than what you think I'm saying. But I don't believe that you maintain the grace thing without a significant walk. And do you know what? Pagans don't pray because they're afraid that God might be there. They really are. Remember I said you could win the argument, of the theistic argument? Because truth is on our side. You know, there's just no question that there's a God. But it's hard to be a pagan. I remember one time telling Larry King, we were having lunch, and he was in Miami. It's not because I know him now that he's really famous, but I knew him before when he was a reprobate, still an agnostic. So he was asking me these questions at lunch. And I said, Larry, if I could prove to you beyond a shadow of a doubt that the things that I teach are true, would you then get on your radio and television program and announce to the world that you have come to see the truth of my faith? If I could prove to you beyond a shadow of a doubt. Or are you just asking questions because you like to ask questions? And it's a smokescreen because you don't want to know the truth. And he was quiet, and he's a very honest guy. And he's quiet, and he said, nobody ever asked me that before. So I have to think about that. And then he said, I'll get back to you on it. And he never did. That it's hard to be a pagan. You know, you can't go see a movie like The Apostle. I mean, that you got to avoid those kind of movies. You can't. If you go to a funeral, what are you going to look at, man? Especially if it's open casket. Now, we don't believe in open casket funerals, but there are a lot of Christians who do. And you know, you got the nose of that corpse sticking out of that thing, and you can see it from your chair, and you know that's a nose of a dead person. What are you going to look at? You going to look out the window? You got to think about something else. You got to think about a baseball or football or something, because if you start thinking about the corpse in the casket, it's going to drive you crazy. You have to be careful the books you read. I mean, you got to read stuff it's got to be fiction and novels. You got to be careful the people who are your friends. I mean, they've got to be vacuous friends who are about as deep as a pool of water in a parking lot. You've got to maintain that forever, because if you ever let up one bit, then all this, and they don't pray. Yeah, well, we're not supposed to do that. I mean, if you're Anglican, they don't allow it. They put a pall over it, so you can't even show the world how much money you spent on the casket. But in most Presbyterian circles, during the actual service, the casket is a closed casket. But I don't know if that's a rule. I don't know if it's in the Book of George Order. But trust me, if you're going to be sophisticated the way I am, you will say to the funeral director, my, I know you have done a wonderful job with the cosmetics and stuff, but you're going to close that sucker or I'm going to embarrass you bad. And so, no, it's open during the wake and all that time, but during the service itself, mostly in Presbyterian circles, the casket is closed. But if you're a pagan, man, you can't deal with that kind of stuff. And so pagans literally do not pray because they're afraid that God might be there. And they know, Romans 1 through 3, that God is there. So they don't pray. You know why you don't pray? Let me tell you why. Because I know, man, I'm under your skin. Because you're afraid that God won't be there. And so it's better to do religious stuff than to check, you know, and believe mildly that this stuff is true. Because if you really get serious about prayer and you find out he's not there, then you don't have anything. And at least, I know, I've been there, man. And it scared the spit out of me to check. Because all of a sudden I realized that's what I was doing. As long as I did religious and did the liturgy and didn't do my own stuff and didn't get still and didn't do the stuff to find out if God was really there, then I could hope that he was, even if I doubted that he was. And it's better to hope in something that isn't true than to check it out and find it isn't true, then you don't have anything. And you'll find what I just said to you, God, every one of you, and I want you to know if you'll say that to your people, it'll get them too. Because it's sort of like the emperor is naked. Yeah, the reason we don't get serious, it's so much easier to discuss theology than it is to pray. And it's safer. It's a lot safer. It's a lot safer, and I'm for corporate prayer, to pray with a group of people because they can take up the slack and you don't have to really find out whether or not God's there. But just to sit still and to be still before God and see if he's there, that's something we're really, really afraid. The eternal silence is frightening me. And they do you too. And I want you to know, as an old guy, I've checked he's there. I just want you to know that. That right after I prayed that prayer, I got 4 or 5 copies of Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline. I mean, it's just, you know, I get publishers, but everybody in a country that knew me started sending me this copy of Celebration of Discipline. By the way, it's a wonderful book, Richard Foster's book. And it doesn't mean discipline, like be disciplined. It's the disciplines of the faith, like meditation and lots. It's a good book, trust me. And so I was speaking at Seattle Pacific University for their Let's Get Religious Week. And the president picked me up. And Foster had been the speaker the year before at what I was doing. And when I got off the plane and walked down the thing and got in the car with this president of the university, I said to him, before anything else, I said, tell me about Richard Foster. And I said, I hadn't read there, he was just sitting on my desk. And he said, he's not a real good speaker, but he was good. I said, I don't mean that, I don't care how he speaks. Does he really believe this stuff, or is he another con artist? And that was my cynicism. He said, oh, no, man, he really, really believes it. And I got to shake his hand one time, by the way. Richard Foster has done some bad stuff like the rest of us. But he's a man who really knows God. And I trusted in Richard Foster's knowledge of God when I didn't know God because I knew that he knew God. One time, no, I need to keep going. It was a good story, but it's not relevant. Doesn't take much encouragement. That's what Edmund used to say. At Wheaton, we don't encourage dating. We don't have to. Well, you don't. but that was the beginning. I read Foster's book, and I'd read previous to that books like The Other Side of Silence by Kelsey, which is a book of heresy, but every other paragraph says good stuff. But there's so much New Age, Eastern stuff in that, I just thought, I can't deal with this. I'd read a lot of the contemplatives of the church, and I felt like I was drowning. I'd read of others who were modern-day contemplatives, and then I would hear stories about who they really were, and they were hustling a buck, and it drove me up a wall. But when I found out Richard Foster was real, I read his stuff, and then I read his footnotes, and then I started reading the places he sent me, and I began to get this cognitive understanding of what needed to happen in my life. At the same time, God started waking me up early in the morning. I was not, to that point, an early morning person. I mean, my wife used to bring coffee or orange juice to my bed and kick me to get me out of bed. And now it's the opposite. She sleeps in and I'm up early. I woke up at 4 o'clock one morning and thought, "What? This is a terrible hour. What am I doing?" And then I tried to go back to sleep and I couldn't go back to sleep. And then I thought, well, maybe it's my sin, but I didn't do anything worse than I'd done the day before, and I slept good then. And so I just said, what the hey? So, and there was a shower in my study at the church. So I went to the church and took a shower and shaved, and those were the days when I shaved. And just sat down and began to be still. And I want you to know, and I tried early. I'd read that John Wesley got up at 4 in the morning, that he tried to get up at 6, and he tossed and turned. Then he tried at 5, and he still tossed and turned. Then he tried at 4, and he slept soundly. And then he had all those hours to work, and I thought, I can do that. So I set my alarm clock and got up at 4 o'clock in the morning. After about 2 weeks, man, I was falling asleep in my sermons. And so there was something supernatural happening. I was wide awake, and I was refreshed. And so that was the beginning of what is, and I don't want this to sound pietistic, because it's not. And you need to know I'm not pious in the literal etymological understanding of the word pious. I'm really not. When I wrote my book on prayer, the guy Tim Jones, who's a wonderful editor, and he headed up this evangelical thing of a secular publisher, and he said he offered me a lot of money, the more than I ever got. Pagans pay a lot better than Christians do. And he said, we want you to write a book on prayer. And I started laughing. I said, we don't have enough books on prayer. I said, I'm just looking at my own library, and I see two shelves filled with books on prayer, and all of them are very good. You need another book on prayer? And he laughed, and he said, no, all those are written by experts. And what he wanted, well, it was a good statement to me. He said, I've heard you talk about prayer, and I want you to write about it. I want you to be honest. I don't want any, and he used some words that I can't use in this class. But he said, I don't want any of that. I want you to just be honest about the book on prayer. So some of the things that I'm going to tell you about prayer, I don't want you to think of in a pious way. Or when I say walk with God, I don't want you to think of it in that way. But this is an honest statement as I know. And I've said this to you before, but it's true. If I couldn't get up in the morning if it weren't for him. I mean, it's coffee and Jesus, man. And coffee and Jesus get me up in the morning. And you say, good Lord. I can understand the coffee part, but the Jesus part, I mean, what do? Just get on your knees and sing songs of praise and go through the Psalms and the attributes of God? No, generally I cuss and spit. And I tell God exactly what I think. And I tell him stuff that if I told you, you would reject me. But he never does. And so there's been stuff that I've learned about prayer that is real stuff. And I want you to know that I've checked and he really is there. And sometimes, though not always, sometimes I can stand before people and say, I was with the Father this morning, and mean that in the most literal way that you can say it. And if I can do it, a monkey can do it. I just want, and this is not rules, by the way. I have a lawyer friend. He's a malpractice lawyer friend. He found Christ. And I love him a lot. He lives in Tampa. And he came into my office. He said, oh, man. Said, I started reading in Genesis. He said, God ain't what I thought he was. Said, he's killing children and animals and wiping out nations and people. And then he stopped and he grinned. He said, now, don't get me wrong. He's my kind of guy. And one time he came in, he said, Steve, I got this book on prayer. He said, I know what my problem was. My problem was I didn't know the rules. I know the rules now. I can do this. He said, I'm a lawyer. And I saw him a couple of weeks later. I said, how did that book work? He said, it was awful. I threw it away. He said, my prayer life wasn't very good before I read it, but it was worse after I read it. So I think it's very important. You know, I know the Acts methodology of praying or the way you pray through the Lord's Prayer, and all those things are kind of helpful. But they're dangerous because they forget that God is not somebody you go through the Acts system to make sure you did it right. And the more we try to do it right, the less right it is, because God is God, and He's quite fond of us, and He welcomes us. And I don't, you know, I have two or three guys that I'm accountable to. One is in a third world country right now, and my producer says it's always good to have somebody you're accountable who travels a lot. Then I think maybe he makes a good point. But you know, when Eddie's home and we spend time together, I don't say, am I saying it right to Eddie? Eddie's Jewish and a Jewish believer in Christ. But I don't sit, when we sit out at lunch, man, what I said to you about, boy, that was such a good book that I wrote. And then I felt really funny. I thought, oh, I shouldn't have said that. But it really was a good book. I mean, I didn't know it was that good when I read it. It's a book on the Holy Spirit. If you really want to know about the Holy Spirit, get my new book, Follow the Wind. And so, but when I said that to you, and even when I'm saying it now, I feel kind of uncomfortable. That's not done in Christian circles. You can't say things like that. I mean, you shouldn't brag about. I mean, if you do something good, let other people toot the horn. And if they don't, that's okay, because God's what we're about, and that's the praise. All those thoughts went through me when I slipped and told you how good my book was. I tell you, I don't even think those things when I'm around Eddie. First thing I'm going to see, when I see Eddie, when he gets home, I'm going to say, Eddie, man, you've got to read my book on the Holy Spirit. It's wonderful. And I'm not going to feel funny around him. I'm not going to feel that I said anything inappropriate. And if I want to tell, if Eddie and I might tell an off-color story, and we'll laugh and I won't wince and think, oh, it's just awful. How could we do that? I don't have to think about how to be. I've known Eddie for 30 years. And he knows everything about me, and he loves me, and I love him. And we've walked in a lot of places and fought a lot of battles together, been to many countries together, and we love each other. So I don't have to plan. And just the way that I don't have to plan when I'm around Eddie, when I really pray, I don't have to plan. And the more you plan, the worse it gets. Now, you can plan. A new Christian can plan. A person who's growing in Christ should not plan. Later on the other side of your understanding of grace, it's okay to plan. It's sort of like simplicity on this side of complexity isn't worth anything. Simplicity on the other side of complexity is worth everything. Planning on this side of grace is necessary to learn how to pray. Planning on the other side of grace is okay. But when you're growing in it, it's very important that you go to Him remembering He's not a system. He's not a theological construct, and the rules do not work. And the reason I say that in the seminars is because people have been going to a Gothard seminar, and they're looking for a system. And because I've got another acrostic called silence, and so I'm going to give it to you. And it's my great fear that people will look at this acrostic, will make some rules about prayer, and say, like my lawyer friend, that I now know the rules, so I got this thing, I can do it. If you do it with rules, it's not prayer, okay? I used to, we did a tape in our ministry of my testimony called The Reluctant Follower or Reluctant Disciple or something. And because so many people were saying I wasn't a Christian, and we decided we'd put together this thing. I had a lady write me one time, and she said, I thought you were kidding when you said people didn't think you were a Christian. She said, I told my Bible study I listened to you, and now they don't think I'm a Christian. So I really did this honest testimony, and we put it on tape. And then on the flip side of it, some apologetic, pop apologetics, where you answered questions that people asked. And then I on the radio program, I have to say, if you'll write for this, we'll send it to you free. And then I'd say, by the way, I've never robbed a bank. I'm not gay. I've never been a drunk. In fact, I don't drink. I can't get the stuff down. I've never done that kind of thing, but it's an honest testimony of God's grace. Well, I didn't even more than say that. I started getting letters from people who understood grace, and they said, but you could have, couldn't you? And you're giving the wrong impression. And so thereafter, after the first week, every time I said that, I said, I never robbed a bank, but I wanted to. And I never slept around, but I thought about it. And I've never done the really gross stuff that you get titillated with if you hear somebody's testimony. I've never been on drugs. But I thought a pot was something you cooked in. I didn't know it was something you smoked. And if I had known, I'd have done it. And I had to say that because I was saying to people something that wasn't true, that I am better than those who do the drugs and sleep around and do the other stuff. And Wendy, I think the nature of the Pharisee is by the way, I'm beginning to see that legalists and Pharisees are people who know that and who really want to please God but don't understand the grace thing and are to be pitied in great ways, as is the older brother. Because the father, now and says to the older and younger son, he says that the father loved both of them the same. He said to the older brother, the Pharisee, the uptight, angry legalist who had never done anything wrong, and said, you have never killed a calf for me. You never had a party for me. And he said, son, everything I have is yours. In other words, he didn't get angry at him any more than he got angry at the son who was with the pigs. But the father knew that the kid with the pigs wasn't any worse than the kid who stayed home and did it all right. So I think one of the most dangerous prayers that you can pray, because God almost always answers it positively, is saying, God, show me myself. I really want to know. And I know that you're gracious, and maybe some of the stuff you're going to show me about myself would be too much. And so I trust you about that. But I really want to know me. I want to know about me. And I think God does that. I think God begins to reveal stuff about you that you just never thought was possible. And generally, in your area, Wendy, it wouldn't be the gross things. It would be in areas of, I don't even know. You know, if I start calling them, you'll start thinking I've been reading a diary or something. I haven't. I used to pray the pastoral prayer I almost had a divorce over it at Key Biscayne. I used to, charismatics would call it a word of knowledge, but it wasn't. I just knew people. And so I'd say, Lord, there's a man here that had to have a drink to come. And man, he's taking mints so that nobody can smell it on him, but you know. And I'd say, Father, there's a woman here whose husband last night told her he didn't love her anymore, and she's dying. She's bleeding to death. And there was a couple in the church, and I do things like that, a lot of those kinds of very normal things that are always present in a congregation. This couple was sitting there, and he told her the night before he didn't love her, and it had just killed her. And he was sure that she'd gone straight to me to tell him about her and was threatening to file for divorce on Monday because of that. So I want you to know I have no supernatural powers to know what your sin is, but I know it's as bad as Jeffrey Dahmer's. Yeah, he'll break you with it. Yeah, that's very true. Exactly. When we get into the 7-step program, part of that is the mourning about who you are and the reality of what God has revealed you. And there is joy in the other morning. There really is. But there's almost a time when you go through the dark night when you recognize, man, it's me, O Lord. It ain't my brothers and it ain't my sisters. It's me, O Lord. And I'm in desperate need here and I'm going to die if you don't come. And then you can hear the angels go in unison. Yes! And you can hear the laughter of God if you're quiet enough. And that's the beginning of the restoration that leads you to grace. But the initial thing is quite painful when you say, God, show me myself.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U, at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.